Nigel, thanks for joining us today. How's it going?
Very well, thank you. Very well.
Good, 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 good. We always open the podcast off in the same way. So I'll ask you the same question we ask everyone. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
Okay, that's a great question. So my name's Nigel Dunand, and I own a Sandler franchise based in the Birmingham area. So typically, the problem I solve is the successful entrepreneurial business owner often gets to a point where they want to scale up their business and they think, what I really need to do is hire some sales guys. Now, often that thought is the problem, but they then run into the challenge of, how do we recruit? How do we onboard? How do we find good salespeople? Most of my customers have maybe just enough experience at this to know that it is fraught with disaster. It can be the most expensive mistake that any entrepreneurial business owner will ever make, hiring the wrong sales guy. Even worse, hiring the wrong sales manager. So I work a lot with those guys trying to de-risk that process of hiring, recruiting, hiring, and onboarding sales guys.
And what are the, because I imagine that sounds nice, right? But I bet there's people out there who are sat with a sales team that aren't right or a sales leader that isn't right, and they don't know what the symptoms are of having that problem. So in your experience, what are the common symptoms if someone's sat listening to this right now of you have one of those problems?
Well, here's a great question. So here's a common thing. Let's say they've got half a dozen sales guys. Two of them are over quota, over budget, doing really well. Two of them are under budget, not doing so well. And then there's two in the middle that, depending on what time of the month or what month of the year you're talking to them, could be on either side of that. And then the thought in their head was, gosh, if I could have all of them behaving like these two, that would be nirvana for me. So that's one symptom. Another symptom is that they struggle to get sales guys productive, onboarded fast enough so they can productive and they bring money in. So they're constantly thinking, well, he's sort of getting there. But if they had known right at the beginning that it was going to take that long for the guy to get there, they maybe wouldn't have hired him in the first place. And then the third one is, and this is surprisingly common, you have a really good guy, but then he leaves. And now he'll usually make some sort of excuse like, oh, it was a better opportunity, it was more money. But really what he's trying to tell you is that he doesn't believe that you've got the systems and processes in place for him to be as successful as he can. So he's going to go somewhere else where he does believe they've got the systems and processes in place. So those probably make three main symptoms that helps.
It's interesting you talk about people leaving because of the symptoms and processes. And obviously, we're big fans of the Sandler process. I hear it more and more often on LinkedIn now that sales methodologies are outdated and they can box you in. Are they right or are they wrong?
Well, I think you got a choice here. You can go with the wing it school of sales management, or you can decide, hang on, winging it is okay if there's one of you. Like if you're an entrepreneur or business and it's just you, then wing it. But as soon as you want to scale up and you've got five, six different people each doing their own thing, that is a management nightmare. So you need a process, you need a system. Now, I'm not saying you need the Sandler process, it doesn't matter, but you have to have something. Otherwise, the salesperson will default to however the customer wants to treat him. Does that make sense?
Mm. Yeah.
So the when I'm interviewing sales directors, that's one of the questions I'll ask them is, tell me about the sales system that you have. And how do you hold your sales guys accountable for sticking to that process?
Hmm.
If the sales director says, well, every situation is different and I hire experienced sales guys and they know what to do, then I'll turn around to the owner of the business who's looking to hire the sales director afterwards and just say, do you want a guy that doesn't know how to control the sales guys, or do you want a guy that's got systems and processes? So yeah, usually an owner wants a sales director, systems and processes.
I'm with you. It's like, how do you make things repeatable time after time? And it's, I always say, like we are big on Sandra and the methodology, but it doesn't really matter. It's like, pick something and stick to it, because how can you look back and fix it if you don't know what you're doing in the first place? So I guess I'm curious as well, like, have you tried other systems and processes, and what faults did you find along the way until you landed at Sandler? You don't need to get into a slagging match with others.
Well, so this is the amazing. So I started off my journey for all of this started in the States. I had worked in the UK, but I got sent out to the States to build up our sales force in the US and then Canada and then Mexico. And it was only when I was in the States, this goes back 20 odd years, that I got exposed to loads of different so-called training methodologies, different systems. All of them. And frankly, we used to send our sales guys to all these things. It was usually a 1 or 2 day boot camp. They'd come back at the end of that going, oh yeah, that was great. Come Monday morning, nothing had changed. So the real difference with Sandler was it wasn't a one-shot deal. It was an ongoing reinforcement program for imparting real skills and getting real improvement in the process. That's one thing. Second thing was this. My background's engineering, not sales at all. I started off as an industrial engineer. So with my background, I see everything as, I just visualize stuff as a process. It's usually a manufacturing process. You put resources in at one end, you go down a production line that's got all these different steps, and you get a predictable outcome at the other end. Along the way, and now this is important to answer your question, along the way, you test and inspect. You don't wait until something comes down the end of the production line and then test it and go, oh, it doesn't fit and scrap it. That's expensive. Instead, you test and inspect every single step of the way, which means you get a very nice feedback loop. You don't have to wait all the way to the end till you get that feedback loop to tell you you messed up. And for me, that was, and as simple as it sounds, for me at the time, that was like, whew, great. Because the challenge that we had in sales management and on the leadership side is we were always talking to sales guys at the very end, how do we get this project over the line? When the mistake had been made way up here, we just couldn't identify where. So the Sandler methodology, being able to break it down step by step, test and inspect, have very short loops, that is great. So any system, any process that enables you to shorten up that feedback loop is a winner, as far as I'm concerned. You're far less likely to end up with a load of scrap product, or in the case of sales, 60% of my time used to be spent working on stuff that eventually went nowhere. All these so-called opportunities, quotes, and everything that these sales guys had, 60% of them, more than, went nowhere. So with this methodology, it's the only one I saw that I could go, oh, whew, if we do it properly, we get 100% close rate. Now.
Nice.
Just as a production line, by the way, here's my caveat. If you try to build a production line that gives you 100% quality and no scrap, it's that last 1% starts to get infinitely expensive. But who cares? You're close to 100%. And I couldn't, any other methodology, it was always, you know, quote and hope, or it's a numbers game and all that sort of stuff.
Let's stick on that then. Salespeople and sales leaders,
yeah,
are they born or are they made?
Ah, great question. What do you think?
There's things that are red flags for us when we're interviewing that didn't used to be through doing this game for a little while. Yeah. The leadership one, I don't know. I don't know if it's an exposure game. Once you're exposed to it, you can see what works and what doesn't. Is it curiosity as a habit? I'm not sure. We're much younger in this game than you are.
Yeah. So, so I'll answer this question in a couple of ways. It is, frankly, I think, insulting to suggest to a really effective sales guy that's super duper successful that he was born and not made. Most, and I'm talking about the A players now. I'm not talking about a guy that's averagely okay. I'm talking about an A player. They will have honed and crafted their skill. These guys are made, not born. You would never, for example, I mean, how ridiculous is this? You know, if little Zach pops out of mummy Zach and daddy Zach goes, oh, look, a doctor. It's not going to happen. Oh, a marketing person. It's not going to happen. So we're made. Now, that's one part of the answer. There are some competencies that really help with sales. And I think a lot of people don't have a good understanding of this. One of my questions when I'm interviewing sales directors are, what are some of the competencies that make for a good salesperson? And, you know, most sales directors, when they ask, they'll probably answer that in two different ways. One of the ways they'll answer it is, a bunch of BS. They just. Second way they might answer it is, oh, hadn't really given that much thought, but let me think about it. And then they'll come up with a few things. And just occasionally you'll get someone who's done the research and knows exactly what they're looking for and can tell you. So those are few and far between, but just by merely asking the question at interview sort of encourages them to go and find that out before they come for the next interview. Does that make sense? So if you're talking about sales competencies, there's some very, very good assessments out there that I suggest people use that look for things like ambition and drive. Now, ambition and drive isn't the be-all and end-all, but ambition and drive gets us over a lot of hurdles. If you're struggling to learn about the product, struggling to get past the gatekeeper, struggling to learn sales technique, just the fact that you want to be successful will get you over that. Second one, what we would call self-awareness. Having enough self-awareness so you can critique yourself in the moment is huge. Certainly be able to debrief yourself afterwards and just ask questions like, that was pretty good, but what could I have done 10% better? That is huge. So self-awareness is great. Another good one is accountability or self-accountability. Great question to ask a salesperson is, hey, how do you hold yourself accountable for doing the stuff that you know you're going to do, but you hate doing, i.e. a lot of prospecting. And it's great. I mean, I learn a lot when I ask people those questions in interview, because occasionally I have some people that give me some good tips. Obviously, there's some secondary ones in terms of technique, you know, questioning and qualifying, listening skills, etc. But if you want the main ones, I would say self-awareness and ambition and drive. Those are sort of non-negotiable for me. If they don't have the self-awareness, they're often very, very difficult to coach and train and get them up that ramp quickly. Now, for sales leadership, sales management, it's a bit different, because that high ambition and drive that works great for a salesperson isn't necessarily what I want to see in a sales director. Because a sales director, I want them more process-oriented than goal-oriented. So a sales guy, for example, their goal is to get the deal over the line. Sales director, their goal is to have a system and process so they can coach their guys so they can get deals efficiently over the line. Does that make sense? So a sales director, by definition, I want more process-oriented, and a salesperson, I want goal-oriented. So, and a lot of this stuff you can learn just by using these assessments on your people, you can learn a lot of this stuff, and then you can learn how to spot it in candidates. So I thoroughly recommend anyone serious about this, get familiar with, there's a few good assessments out there. Get familiar with those assessments. Use them on candidates, use them on their people. If you use them on your people, it'll give you great coaching tips on how to get them to be more effective and more efficient, and also how to manage people. If somebody's style is different from yours, then you need maybe some clues as to how to manage them. What will work and what won't when it comes to management.
You hit on a few really interesting points there. I'm just going to pull one out. The no self-development without self-awareness piece. You have to have self-awareness to develop. If you were coming into a business and looking at their sales team and trying to assess how self-aware individuals are, what things do you do to ascertain that?
Great question. So there was a client asked me this a while ago, this probably about 3 or 4 years ago. Some guy said, he checked me out. He'd spoken to my client. And he said, I've really struggled to find anyone that said anything bad about you. They'd all had tremendous results. How come? And I told him, and then I just said, I cheat. It's very simple. I cheat. And one of the ways I cheat is to use these assessment tools. Because if I know someone's got ambition and drive and self-awareness, those two, the chances are they're going to be very easily trained. Now, the way I do, so I can run the tool on them and look at their score, but then I can verify it in a session. So we'll typically do a discovery day. We'll call it a discovery day. It might not even last the whole day, but we'll do a discovery day with a team of salespeople. And I can very easily tell whether someone is open to coaching, for example, whether they've got the awareness to know that what came out of their mouth could be improved. So just going back to your favorite topic here, the no pressure phone call, I can get them to deliver their 30 second commercial. And then I can say, hey, that's great, blah, blah, blah. Can I make a suggestion? Oh, okay. Why don't you try it this way around? Instead of focusing on feature advantage benefit, let's focus on the two or three problems you might fix. And I'll give it to them, you know, in a half-assed, sandlerized way, because I don't know their business well enough at this stage, but it'll be better than what they're doing. And I'll point out to them, these words aren't quite right, but look at the concept, give it a shot. So I'll then rerun their 30-second commercial and see how well they can adapt to that. So that's one way, a very, very quick way. I'll give you an example of a disaster. I think it was 10 or 12 sales guys trying to get them to do the no pressure phone call. And 12 times in a row, we had this problem with them picking up the phone. And what do most, you know, the hate, do you know about the hate crime? Hi, how are you today? That, you know, the chippy chirpy voice. I said, 10, 12 times in a row, they did that. I could tell right away this was going to be a disaster. They weren't going to be easily coachable or trainable. So I then figured out with the business owner, you know, these guys I really think you're wasting your time on. No ambition and drive, really tough to coach. Give me these two guys. Let's see what happens. Then when they've proved that it works, then we'll train the other guys. Does that make sense? So that's how I work it. I answered your question a long way around, but
that's brilliant. Rather than because we obviously do sales training as well, but rather than going in there and be like, right, I'll change everything, it's like let me start with the stuff that's willing to change. So
you only need push on an open door. There's so many open doors out. There's, you know, half. Well, this is my third rule, completely unscientific. But when I turn up to a company, a third of the guys there are chomping at the bit, looking to do something different that makes sense to them. A third of them, no way, no how. They are, for whatever reason, they got us stuff going on in their lives. They can't be bothered with it. They've had bad experience, whatever. And there are a third in the middle that are going to take the wait and see attitude. So if I can figure out those three buckets of people, usually with the help of the owner of the business, then it's easy. You just take the top two or three and you work with those and you make sure that they've got the talk tracks and the cookbook and the playbook necessary for them to be successful in their role. And then you can go with that a bit more fully formed to the middle third, who by then are chomping at the bit because they've heard all the great stuff. Please, when can I get on the program? Mm. And the for the other third, the writing's on the wall. You know, shape up or ship out, as the Americans say.
Yeah, it's so good. And the hate crime, hi, how are you? I remember I did some training with a company that sold printers, and I went in and I was like, I listened to them on the first hour. I was like, okay, do you guys enjoy doing that? No, we absolutely hate it. We have no success with it, but we don't know anything else. It's like, there's so... Anyway, that's a session for another day. But when I, Nigel, when I go into training sessions, the thing they always want to talk about, like off the bat, and I think it's people looking for a silver bullet, is objections. So how do you think about objections, and what kind of practical advice can you give us surrounding them?
So here's I do have a couple of pithy little things that will go in a TikTok thing. One of them I already mentioned before, sort of hire slow, fire fast is my tip for training. But on objection handling, we just got to be more proactively reactive. Mm-hmm. Like if we know these objections are going to come up, we can head them off. We can head them off. So that's my main thing, is heading them off. So give me an example. What's a common objection that someone might have or might throw at you?
I'm looking into this, but not till next year.
Not till next year. All right. Mm. So, in that, for me, that's a no. But anyway, I would, on my upfront contract, on the phone, chat with them. And I would say right up there in the upfront contract, hey, not sure whether any of this is important to you, not sure whether you enjoy it, but why don't we spend, you know, 3 or 4 minutes talking about this? And at the end of this, you can decide whether or not it's important enough for us to put a date in the diary. Fair?
Fair.
And they'll always say, yeah, sure, great. And then you talk to them about it using our pain funnel questions. And then you just ask, look, I don't know. We've been chatting now, I think, for about 5 minutes. Is this important enough to you that we put in the date in the diary, have a follow-up meeting? So there is no option then to say, oh, well, let's go next year. It's either a yes or a no.
Okay. What about, well, let me throw this one at you. Yeah. So we start talking. I go, oh, it's great, but we already work with a sales training company.
Great. So all these things are common objections. And what we need to create is a playbook. So I got a whole playbook for all of this stuff for training. So a great one for so give me the exact wording of that objection again, and I'll give you the answer.
We've already got a sales training company in place.
Great. And you've already made up your mind that there's nothing there in the market that would be more effective or more suitable for you. Is that what you're telling me?
No, but they're pretty good.
Which means
that I don't know what I don't know.
Okay. If there was something that you thought they might be able to help you with more than they are, or if there was something that they're not giving you that you'd hope you would get, any idea what that might be?
I get so excited by Sandler. Nigel, I love it. It's so good. It's so good.
What's the rule here I'm using here?
You're testing it. You're temperature checking it.
There's only one person that's qualified to overcome the objection. Who's that?
Of course, me.
It's the prospect. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to have them overcome their own objection. So that's the two things I've given you. The preventative is make sure you cover that up front. And then when we're in the conversation, have them. So this means getting people very good with all the different questioning strategies and comfortable with it.
Hmm. Okay. What are your, this if we're talking TikTok soundbite, here's one for you.
Yeah.
What's your opinion on feel, felt, found?
In terms of
good, bad, ugly, what is it?
Well, I feel, felt, found in what context?
As an objection handling technique. So I was on a show a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking as the only way to, like you say there, the only person that could handle an objection is them.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I'm on that. A common objection handling routine from the 70s is, I totally understand how you feel. And then take, I don't use it. So when I spoke to other customers, they found and they felt that that kind of stuff.
Well, look, here's the thing with this. I think that, it's okay. I would say it's good, but it's not great. Because in my mind, that sounds, it's bordering on sounding salesy. Does that make sense? And this is difficult to do. I'm not saying it's easy, but we've got to avoid at all times looking salesy, because the more we push, the only thing you get back from them is pushback. So I'm going to make sure I stay, as we say in Sandler, behind the pendulum. You see, what I'm looking for on a phone call is to get the guy to tell me, no, I don't need your stuff, leave. So by definition, I'm going to sound very, very different. So in that earlier conversation that we had where we started to role play that, and I was asking you for, I don't know, what were you hoping they could do with this better? Eventually, in that conversation, I would say, look, from what you're telling me, they're producing all the results you want to. They're really good at what you're happy with them. Unless I'm missing something, it sounds like there's no reason for us to talk, is there? They'll say, no, probably not. And I'll say, ever. And then they will say, well, I didn't say ever. I say, I'm sorry. What did you say? Well, maybe we can talk again in 6 months' time. And then I'll start the whole thing again. 6 months? Why 6 months? Why don't we leave it a year? I'm curious. Why 6 months? So the whole thing is, I'm having fun, obviously, at the same time of doing it, but I'm not interested in playing the traditional sales game. The feel, felt, found is okay. It's better than, hey, well, we got this better mousetrap with this feature and larger benefit. My fear would be if it might sound a little bit like, oh, this guy's trying to get me to say something I don't want to say. Does that make sense? Whereas if I'm doing it correctly, and I don't always do it correctly the sound of the way, I mean, it's tough. You know? even though I've been doing this 70 years, it's easy to have tremendous, unbelievably great results with it. It's just difficult to do because it conflicts with some of the stuff in our head. But if I'm doing it right, and I'm really looking for the no, and I'm just intent on trying to understand what that person's after, then I'm going to sound like I'm someone sitting around at their side of the table, and we're not having the conversation across the table. We're looking at their problem together. Tell me more about that. Help me understand. I don't understand. I know you're telling me this is a problem, but you've been doing this way for 3 years, 5 years, how long now? It's all going well, nothing fell over. Why would you want to do anything different now? You know, those are the brave questions. Those are the questions that, you know, if you want to be successful, you've got to ask the questions that the other guy's too scared to ask. So even when you do get someone on the hook that does want to buy, you've got to ask those sorts of questions too.
Beautiful. There was a really subtle question. I don't know if this is a Nigel question or a Sandler question. Jack said something and you said, which means, and then he had to go deeper on the point that he'd made. I love stuff like that. But you don't get a clear enough answer, which means, keep going, pad that out.
Part of the question he said, which another great one is, and? So? Even better.
Yeah.
Keep it zipped.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. I'll chuck a LinkedIn hot topic for you and get your take on it.
Okay.
Is enterprise selling different than if I'm selling from A to B. I can ring managing director on the phone tomorrow, or if I'm selling HR system to HR director, they need to get approval from CEO and CFO. Is that a different skill set entirely?
Yeah. Well, so what I would say is what we need to do in enterprise selling is exactly the same. How we do it is very, very different. Enterprise selling is team selling, and more importantly, team buying. And nowadays, more and more people are getting wrapped up in the decision-making process at the buyer's end. Enterprises that used to, that whole enterprise, that's how enterprises buy. That's, we're seeing that more and more in even medium-sized companies. So this is team buying. And so we've still got to do the same thing, still got to through the same process, but with more people. Does that make sense? So it's a lot more costly as well. So if you pursue enterprise opportunities, can be extremely costly to pursue. So we need, even, you know, those in right at the beginning, I mentioned the, you know, test and inspect. We got to be really, really thorough on those inspections, because if we make too many mistakes, letting less than ideal so-called opportunities go to the next stage, that can be very costly, because that can involve trials, it can involve engineering drawings, it can involve prototyping. And then you find out, once you've, after 18 meetings, that actually, as far as the board is concerned, this is not the strategic direction the company wants to go in. I mean, that's, why didn't you find that at meeting one? You know, So
it sounds like you're saying be even harder on the disqualifying when it comes to enterprise, so that you're not wasting your time on subsequent meetings.
It's more important to be, and the mistake that so I do a lot in the engineering world here, and the mistake that engineering technical companies make is that they focus too early and too much on what's the technical solution for this thing. And then get caught off downstream when they start to talk about the commercial opportunity. So we need to make sure this is thoroughly flipped around, so we have a really strong commercial conversation up front, asking far more strategic questions. You know, what's the purpose of this? How's this fit into your long-term plan? How does a company like ours get to do business with a company like yours? What's the sort of hoops that you think we need to jump through? Those sorts. How are you going to fit? I understand this is an intriguing thing for you here, but how are you going to be able to, what's your process for figuring out return on investment on this thing? Can we have that conversation up front? And who do we need to involve in that?
Nice, okay.
Instead of leaping straight into solution and then trying to sell it to them.
Okay, so then what's the, I won't ask you to give away all your secrets, but what are the...
Hey, I'm not giving you, right, here's the thing, I can give away secrets till the cows come home. You can't do it without a lot of practice.
Mm.
So this only benefits people who are prepared to put in the time and effort to have a conversation on this stuff, you know, an hour a week, or, you know, half an hour when you're stuck or whatever. You know, you got to do that. Otherwise, it doesn't happen. You don't make any progress.
So the
methodology really is nothing to do with the methodology that you guys think it is. The Sandler methodology is the fact that it's ongoing reinforcement, and you've always know you've got someone to call when you get stuck, and you share best practice, and you document it, and you track the right stuff, etc. So by definition, it's an ongoing thing.
Mm, it's like AA for salespeople.
AA for salespeople. AA for salespeople. And of course, you never leave AA.
No, of course. Okay, so then I'll one last thing on enterprise, and before we move on, let's say you've had a meeting with someone, but you're aware that there are other stakeholders involved, and you want to have some really concrete next steps, but you're scared because typically the end of these calls are, I might never hear from someone again. What's good practice to get into to finish up those meetings in terms of next steps?
Okay, so number one rule It's not in the book quite like this, but I have people write this down. It's a ghastly acronym. BAMFAM. BAMFAM. Book a meeting from a meeting. So if you're meeting with your champion, you know you've got loads of other people that you've got to get around and think, but whatever you do, make sure you finish that meeting with a date in the diary booked with that other meeting and a reason why they want to meet, why they want their reason for wanting to meet with you. If you do that, you'll keep this thing on track. It might not go fast, but at least you'll be on a track. As soon as you don't have a date in the diary, that opportunity is no longer in your pipeline. It's in your prospecting funnel somewhere. It's only in your pipeline if there's a date in the diary. So that's my number one thing for that.
Beautiful.
There's that now, and I'll be asking this guy, who else is going to get involved in this? What do you think? I know you're keen on this. What, I'd hate to let you down. Are you going to be okay sort of coaching me through the relationships with these people? I'll probably need a lot of your help trying to negotiate, certainly your purchasing department and any other key players here. Is this important enough to you that we sit down, carve out an hour or two and over coffee, you know, draw me the roadmap for what we're going to need to do?
Me and Zach we were literally talking. I didn't know it was called BAMFAM. I love that. Yep. I think I'm going to be using that a lot moving forward, Nigel. But me and Zach were literally talking about this the other day. Like if you're looking at your pipeline and I say to you, right, Zach, where are you up to with this deal? And you go, oh, I don't know. I need to chase. It's, like you say, it's out of the pipeline. Right, it's into prospecting. Nailed it. Nigel, me and Zach, we're big fans of Sandra. We're big fans of sales done properly. So we could speak to you all day. I guess a lot of young people listening to I remember I got taught Sandler for the first time when I was 21 in one of my first sales jobs. I didn't pay much attention. I thought that I sold by being a cheeky chap and building rapport and talking about family and football. It didn't work.
Captain Humor. Listen, Captain Humor works. The old cheeky chappy. There is room for the cheeky chappy in the Sandler.
Yeah. You need to have the pain and the problem solving. There was none of that right. going on. So
well, the structure will help the cheeky chappy. Because now they're being exactly. cheeky chappy strategically.
I agree. But now 10 years later, I've understood the power of Sandler. So if we go back to me when I was 21 and other young people that are listening to this, what are the five tips you'd give? Let's end on a real high. What are the five tips you'd give for anybody that's starting off a career in sales? What should they know now that you wish you knew when you was 21? Rather than waiting years and years to learn these secrets, what are the five actionable takeaways?
Okay, so if I was talking to a guy, and you're talking about a guy starting off in a sales job with some corporate or some organization, okay,
yeah. So
first thing I would do, and I would do this at the interview, is I would want to make sure that they really do believe in it, investing in their people and not just paying lip service to it through HR with the investors in people little stamp, you know. So, because if you're joining a company where they've got a program of ongoing reinforcement training, you will learn. You need to be in an environment where you can learn. So that's one thing. Second thing I would say, find a mentor. Find someone who, for whatever reason, and you'll be surprised, there are a lot of good people around that are looking to help other people. Find a mentor. Find someone that is maybe a few years ahead of you on their sales career path. And they're going in roughly the direction you're headed in. And see if they can't mentor you. Next thing I would suggest is a peer group. So find people who are equally ambitious as you are and hold each other accountable. So you can have a little Friday afternoon accountability meeting where you go over, hey, I said I'd do this, this, and this. I did this. I half did that. I didn't do the other one. Let them beat you up a little bit. Then hold you account for accountable for doing the stuff you want to do. The next bit is maybe premature for the guy that's just starting, but I'll throw this in because it's relevant. Is as soon as you are able, become a mentor. If you're a mentee and a mentor, and you've got your peer groups, this really keeps you on a trajectory. Does that make sense? Mm. Now, you will learn, and you know this, you figured this one out. You learn as much from the people that you are mentoring as from your mentor. So they'll ask you questions that you'll go, why is it? Why do I do that? Why is that the best way to do it? And it'll just make you think. So that's that. And then the my other hot tip is around goals. So be really, really clear about what your personal and professional goals are. If there's one program you go on a goal setting program. Most people at school doesn't teach you this. They don't say, no one ever says, hey, if you really want to achieve stuff in life, make sure you have goals. I mean, you may have heard it, but they don't then show you how to do it. Hmm. So get on a goal setting program. I mean, we've got a book that you can buy and go through it or go through with your friends, colleagues, partner. Because if you are really clear about what your personal goals are and what your professional goals are, it helps with those day-to-day decisions. Without personal goals, you are more likely to become part of somebody else's plan. If you have your own goals and your own plan, then you'll find other people and they will become part of your plan. And, that, as David Sanders said, we have two shots, the one decision you make in life, you've got one shot at it. So you've got to decide, are you going to have your plans and find people that are going to help you with your plans? Or are you just going to end up by default part of somebody else's plan? So make sure you know what those goals are.
There's a lot of cliche sales advice and life advice out there, Nigel, but I think me and Zach can both agree that this conversation has been very refreshing, and that's actually strong, even for us. Like, I'm listening to that and I've taken so much away from this conversation already. So thank you for coming today. I guess if people want to work with you or check you out, where can they get in touch?
They can Google, unfortunately or fortunately, and I have to behave myself, I've got a very Googleable name, Nigel Dunand, and they can contact me through my LinkedIn. If they contact me through LinkedIn, then one of the things I always like to do is offer someone to check out my connections. If someone on LinkedIn that's a connection of mine looks like it might be helpful for them, and I'll at least get them past the gatekeeper.
I love it. Nigel, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.